Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing, and it's Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. And we have several bills on the agenda. First up today is Senate File 452, Senator Champion. This is Jobs and Health Innovations Grant Program for Hard-to-Employ Minnesotans, Establishment and Appropriation.
So, to start off, good to see you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for having me today. And I will say that I think this is my first time appearing in front of this committee. Is that true? Or did I appear? No, this is my first time appearing in front of this committee, because I would remember. So thank you for having me.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. When we all appear in front of the Judiciary Committee for the first time, there's a tradition that goes on there. So I would hope that one would offer that same tradition here in Health and Human Services. Just saying that, Madam Chair. So,
Madam Chair, I know what Senator Hoffman is referring to. He's referring to me bringing donuts, and I want him to know, hey, next time, said Senator. Again, thank you for having us. This bill today is a great bill. And it's also a great bill because the substance of it is wonderful, but it's also my understanding that my senator, she used to be my senator for 16 years, Senator Linda Higgins is sitting here, but she's now Commissioner Higgins, and she introduced a similar bill some time ago, and so I'm excited to have Senator/Commissioner Higgins here today as we talk about Senate File 452. And Senate File 452 has bipartisan support. It's a bipartisan jobs and health innovation grant program based on the successful multi-year effort to develop best practices for assisting individuals that are leaving our correctional facilities. The original legislation started this endeavor passed in 2007 with the support of now, as I mentioned earlier, Hennepin County Commissioner Linda Higgins, who is one of the testifiers. So you'll get a chance to hear from her today. I'm going to kind of keep giving some context, and then I have a delete all amendment that I would hope that this committee would adopt. This bill is for $4 million to create a fund that can be used by DHS or the Department of Human Services to support better futures as it continues to develop best practices and serve as a model and to build additional sites using these best practices at other locations in the state. The first being with Northwest Indian OIC in Bemidji, with high incarceration populations, high native populations, low employment, high chemical and alcohol addictions, and others. What we know about individuals that leave our state prisons or the county correction system is that they are most likely homeless, jobless, without post-secondary education, or even high school diplomas. Often they suffer from mental illness and trauma-induced stress, poor physical health, disengaged with family, including their own children. And sometimes these individuals are not paying child support, but we want to make sure that they do so. And if we don't find and use methods that work, we know that they are likely to cycle back into corrections, remain on our safety net programs, and we want to find ways for them to be self-sustaining and for them to be independent and for them to continue to be contributing members of society, because that's what we want them to do when they transition out of corrections. So this model is one that is addressing a larger public health concern among this population through housing concerns, sober living, case management, and reducing them going back to prison. And so the legislation proposed creates a fund to not only support the continuation of this model that was spearheaded some time ago by then Senator Higgins, who is now Commissioner Higgins, but to expand it to other communities in the state. So, Madam Chair, I have a few testifiers who will provide details about this proposal in greater detail, but I'd like to start, if you will so indulge, with my good friend, Dr. Thomas Adams, who is spearheading this wonderful organization called Better Futures.
Thank you. Please welcome and please introduce yourself for the committee. And just to comment, we do have a quorum. So please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Adams. I'm the president and CEO of Better Futures Minnesota. We work with high-risk adults who have chronic histories of unemployment, incarceration, poverty, homelessness, substance abuse, and mental health challenges. What drove me to work with this population is I believe in redemption, I believe in self-sufficiency, and I believe in compassionate accountability. In 2007, the state entered into a partnership with Better Futures Minnesota to identify best practices for working with this population with the goal of taking this population off of long-term dependency and into stabilization and self-sufficiency. We've developed a model that addresses this population's core hurt and trauma, and we also address their basic needs with housing, employment support, and then we provide ongoing case management and life skills for this population. We've crafted these best practices over 8 years, and these best practices work. We've been independently evaluated by three outside internal or external auditors, and we know that men that we serve remain in the community at a higher rate than their counterparts. They are employed at a higher rate than their counterparts. They find stable housing at a higher rate than their counterparts, and they engage with their families and pay child support at a higher rate than their counterparts. So we're excited about the model that we've built. This model is a wonderful example of a public-private partnership. Over 8 years, there's been $24 million invested in this endeavor, $4 million from the state itself, $3 million from Better Futures, about $3 million from Hennepin County, $9 million from the largest public-private public health foundation in the country, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and then other local municipalities, Ramsey County, City of Shoreview, and others. So we're excited about that. We believe that it's now time, after 8 years, to take this model to other communities that can benefit in the state of Minnesota. It's tried and proven, and we believe that this model and the best practices that we've been able to identify can help this population, and we'd like the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Would you like to have your next testifier?
Would you like
to have Commissioner Higgins?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, it's awfully nice to be back with this committee where I've spent so many days of my life. I'm Linda Higgins, Hennepin County Commissioner. Since 2008, Hennepin County has invested about $2.5 million with Better Futures Minnesota. We think it's really important to work with organizations that can do good work with the really hard-to-serve population that Better Futures is working with. Employment, lowered recidivism, housing, reconnection with families, those things are so important. If we want to keep people out of the correction system and being contributing members of our society. You might wonder why we're here in this committee rather than in public safety. And it is because human services really does include all those things that Dr. Adams was talking about. Housing, you can't get very far in life if you don't have a stable place to lay your head at night. And knowing where your things are and a base to call home. Healthcare is another piece that's just so important for your stability in your life in the community. Getting a job is critical. Better Futures helps find jobs and also helps create jobs. The men must pay child support. We have like 100%, right? 100% of the men in this program are paying their child support. Out there in the rest of the world, when people come out of prison, what's it, like 1%, 2% maybe? This program understands how important that is, and that's another reason why human services is part of it. At Hennepin County, we think so highly of this project or this program that our votes to set up the contracts with Better Futures are unanimous. And that is a huge sign of how important we believe this program is. And we'd sure like to have the state as a good partner as well. And I will turn it then over to our last testifier, Warren Williams, who's one of our participants.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Warren Williams, originally from Ohio, but been a resident of Minnesota since 1969. I'm a 9-time convicted felon. I've done over 17 years in my life in prison. One thing that this enterprise, Better Futures, has done for me is that they welcomed me. They accepted me. They didn't shun me, even with my 9 convictions. They taught me how to work. They taught me how to just take ownership of my actions. They held me accountable. And that, now I work a job. I've been working 5 years straight. I never went back to prison. Only time I go back to prison now is to teach. I have my certification and license in restorative justice practices. So now that they invested in me, it's paying off, because now I'm able to be self-sustaining. I pay 100% rent of my rent, and now I'm also going inside different institutions teaching. So I just think this is an awesome enterprise, and I am very humbled and honored to be speaking on this behalf. And this module works. Here I am, a living testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Senator Champion.
Thank you so much. And Madam Chair, another person that we did have as a testifier is Tulia Palmer, who's with the Northwest Indian OIC. And she's based in Bemidji, and they are serving primarily the tribal communities in Northwest Minnesota. And you have a reference letter in your packet, so I just want to call attention to that, because she so eloquently articulates the importance of the work that Better Futures is doing, but the work that they're doing there, and how this investment from the state of Minnesota will allow them to continue the great work that they're doing there. And she can talk about their statistics, and their organization is ready to go. So we believe that this is a good opportunity, or a great opportunity, for the state to continue to help advance this important work. And so with that, Madam Chair, we will stand for any questions that the committee might have, and then I'll be happy to go through the delete all amendment when you are ready.
Senator Champion, maybe we should move the amendment first. And Senator Eaton moves the delete all the, the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries.
And just briefly, Madam Chair, Section 1 and Subdivision 1 of the delete all, which is now in the entire bill, requires the commissioner to establish a grant program with the goal of creating new jobs for long-term and chronically unemployed Minnesotans, and the target population includes individuals who rely heavily on government services. Subdivision 2 states that the objective of the grant program is to provide incentives to private employers to generate new employment opportunities and to foster cross-agency collaborations between local and state agencies. Subdivision 3 requires the commissioner to award the grants and to provide them in an order that shows who's eligible, and the applicants must be a nonprofit organization that can fulfill the requirements in Subdivision 1. And under paragraph C, preference will be given to organizations that demonstrate the ability to meet objectives in a demonstration project for high-risk adults that passed this body in 2007. And you heard Commissioner Higgins talk a little bit about that. Subdivision 4 requires that an organization receiving a grant report certain information to the commissioner, and the commissioner is required to submit an annual report to the legislature on the progress of the grant program. And Subdivision 5 provides that the grants be awarded to up to 3 organizations per biennium. Subdivision 6 requires the applicants match on a one-to-one basis the amount of state funds awarded with non-state funds. Section 2 requires the Commissioner of Human Services, in consultation with the Commissioner of Management and Budget, to calculate the savings generated to the state resulting from the implementation of this grant program, and to examine the feasibility of replenishing funding for the grant program by using the anticipated savings. And so the commissioners shall report the findings by January 15th of 2016. And finally, Section 3 appropriates $4 million for the grant program, and this appropriation does not cancel and is available until the funds are used or expended, and is ongoing. And so no more than 2% of the appropriation may be used for the administration of the grant program. That articulates the entire bill. That's also been the lead-all amendment. And again, Madam Chair, we are prepared to answer any questions from you or the members of this great committee.
Members, are there any questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Champion, as I read through the language on the delete all, I didn't see, and this may be by design, I just wanted to ask, I didn't see that there was any capitation on the amount of the grants. As I read this, they could award one entity $4 million, or they could award 100 entities a much smaller amount. Was that your intent?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, you will see that there at least has to be up to three organizations that receive the funding, so one organization could not receive the entire funding. So we made that intentional, but we did not say what the floor needs to be, but there's a, for lack of a better word, an invisible ceiling, right, because one group could not get 100%. But what we do also think is important, not just based on the investment, but that there's a reporting requirement or mechanism that's here, and that there's some criteria that must be used when they're looking at how the grants are going to be appropriated, right? Because we want to look at the demographic includes and could include veterans or others that have mental health issues, folks who have chronic homelessness. But we do think that we are hitting and addressing this important population. And finally, there's a report for savings, right? Because this body often talks about the investments that we make and what sort of savings is generated as a result of this investment.
Senator Lori, I'm sorry, did you have any
I just want to follow up on that. So we will have at least a minimum of three grants because there's three entities that have to be involved. Is that what you're anticipating, or are you anticipating that we would have a multitude of grants?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, it's my understanding that we're expecting a number of people to apply and for it to be all across the state. In fact, you know, I did talk about the Northwest Indian OIC. We know that's one entity for sure that is going to ask as well. So, yes, sir.
Senator Lori?
I think a couple of us caught this. If that's the intent, I don't think the language quite captures it. The language says that grant awards must be awarded to up to three organizations. I mean, I think that I read that to actually allow it to go to one and certainly not allow it to go to any more than three. So if three is intended to be the minimum, I think we just need a little crafting here because I don't think it's what the language does.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, I will dial a friend because I'm looking for Nancy Hilton. help answer this question. So thank you for the opportunity to dial a friend who is sitting to my right now, Nancy Hilton.
Welcome.
Thank
Please
you.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Nancy Hilton, and on behalf of Better Futures. As drafted, the language contemplates that you don't – what one of the issues that has confronted some of the efforts by organizations doing this work is – you get too little to really accomplish the true agendas. And what you heard from Dr. Adams is that over the past 7 years, there's been an aggregate of about just shy of $25 million that have gone in. Now, there's great savings, and a lot of people serve with that, so that's just a part of it. But if you're just chasing down little small incremental grants, you wind up being just a grant manager rather than actually using your organizational skills to do what we need to do, which is coordinate housing, coordinate jobs, create these work crews. So the idea is to actually not parse this out so thinly that you can't get it done.
But is
Senator Champion?
Up to three.
It was intended to be up to three so that you were keeping it at a minimum, but we're certainly open to talking with the author and if there's comfort added. But the idea was to keep them on the larger size.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment and then a question. As I was reading the bill, the goal of creating new jobs for long-term and chronically unemployed Minnesotans, I think we're missing a really important part here, which is helping provide the needed training or education for or whatever other barrier there is to that long-term employment. I see that as the more permanent solution, which is investing in the people who are currently long-term unemployed with what type of, whether it's education or if there's a chemical dependency issue, whatever it is, I see that as a more permanent solution than the bill before us today, and it worries me a little bit that we're not addressing that. That's my comment. And then my question has to do with the grant awards on page 2, and I would be concerned. I would like to see language in here that would assure that some of the grants go to the non-metro area. The entire state has concerns about this, and we want to serve the whole state, not just one area. So I'm going to ask our staff to prepare an amendment that would make sure that some of the grants, I don't have the exact, but at least one grant goes to the non-metro area. And then in the reporting, always good to get good reporting language here, and I like to see that as well. I think one of the things we should include in that report is what percent of the grants and what percent of the money go to the metro area, and what is those same percentages that go to the non-metro area. And one of the things that I always look for in reports too is what percent goes to women and minorities. I think that those would be some things that would help on that reporting language. And if that's not too much for council to put together in an amendment, I would like to offer that.
And Madam Chair, Senator, if I may speak to Senator Nelson's concerns, we think both of those would make sense to us. It is my understanding the intent is not for this just to be a metropolitan driven or fund, right? We are interested in all of the great state of Minnesota, because when we all do better, we all do better. So we are totally fine with both the outstate language as well as the reporting notions about what percentage goes to the metro area versus non-metro area. That's totally fine with us. And, of course, I have a deep desire around making sure that the target population is women and people of color and also veterans and others, right? So I think this reporting can break down those important notions.
Thank you.
Dr. Adams?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, excuse me, our model has a robust worker skill training and worker development aspect to it. That's one of the best practices we've identified over the 8 years. Initially, we were placing men right into employment, and for many reasons, they weren't able to sustain that employment. Many of the men that come to us have very little work history and have very low transferable work skills. So we're heavy into certification. Our men receive certification in 10 different areas, from small appliance repair to refrigerant removal to OSHA 10 construction training, and they're able to take those certifications and move on into other pathways to employment, in, which will allow them to enter the workforce and keep stability in the workforce. So we're very intentional about the skill building that they need prior to moving into the workforce.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think Ms. White is working on an amendment. In the meantime, we have Senator Marty and then Senator Rosen. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Champion and others, I can live with it being up to three or more than three. I understand Ms. Hilden's concern. You don't make it tiny grants. I think that's appropriate. But I also think if we're going to say, well, we got to have at least, well, if you can have three of them, it's got to be one-third or two-thirds in greater Minnesota. Before we decide where all these things go, I think it would be helpful, whatever you want, whether you want it to be three to five or no more than three, because, I mean, I think this is an important discussion, and I think they need to be sizable enough, but is it, if the intent is to have a big competition and one entity gets it, that's one thing, and I don't think it is from what you're saying, and I think I'm hearing you don't want it to be watered down to too many, but maybe being a little more precise in terms of whether you want no more than three, or do you want three to five? I think the main thing I'm hearing is you don't want 30 of these or 20 of these, but it would be helpful because then we could decide, I mean, do we set aside some for various portions of the state and so on?
Ms. Hilden, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, Nancy Hilden for the record. I think that what we don't know is that we don't know what different organizations may need or not need, so we don't want to get too prescriptive on a certain number. So I think it's very friendly, though, amendment to suggest, three to five or, you know, up to three. I think that's we're trying to leave some flexibility, but you know, if it causes you heartburn, we'll work with you. But we're trying to leave each organization to come in with the proposal they think that works for them.
Senator Barney,
Madam Chair, Ms. Hilden, I'm not having heartburn over too few or too many. I'm just trying to figure out what you want, because I think we should not be very too specific about who's getting what, unless we know. I mean, if you get a $4 million appropriation, is that, do you want to say, like, I mean, I get the sense that you're not talking, Senator Champion, you're not talking one entity going to get it, but you want two or three at least to get that, so maybe you say two to five or three to five. Just, in other words, I think you guys should choose what you want, and then assuming the committee likes that, that seems reasonable. But.
So, Senator Madam Champion? Chair, Senator Marty, I think the language that we have now really addresses the issue or concern that we all have, which is up to three in any biennium. It leaves the level of flexibility around, what an organization would need in order to really fulfill the role. It also still leaves an opportunity for Metro or outstate to also apply and for them to be given what they need and for that to be looked at in a real constructive way. So I think the language that we have currently, it would be appropriate.
Okay. Thank you. We have Senator Rosen, then Senator Nelson, Senator Eat. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. I have actually just two quick questions. There is the program Twin Cities Rise out there, Senator Champion, and I was just wondering if there's some duplication on those two programs and how the difference there. And then I also had a question for Mr. Williams about, I thought what Senator Nelson was saying was actually very good about the skills that are required. What are you teaching when you go into the system to teach?
Well,
Madam
Chair.
Yes, Mr. Williams, please introduce yourself for the record again.
Warren Williams, just for the record. Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator. What I did was I went back and started empowering myself by getting certified in different certifications. So one of my certifications was restorative justice practices. So I go into Stillwater Prison and take the restorative justice practice in there and meet with hundreds of men and just point out where I took my ownership of whatever I did. I'm now self-sustained and working and doing positive things, so they can see that, you know, if I can make it, they can make it. You know, I also went to school for pre-apprentice construction, so I worked as a construction worker for a year and a half. You know, I also got my certification in forklift operations, so I went on to school for that and got my certification. Now I'm working at one of the larger global importers of granite, stone, and marble from all over the world, and I am the assistant manager. And so, you know, it's just awesome how, you know, this program invested in me and now how I'm able to give them a good return on their investment. So
thank you.
Hope that answers your question, ma'am.
Senator Champion. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator
Dr.
Nelson,
Adams.
Or Rosen, when our organization was first started, our name was the Network of Better Futures, and at that time, the CEO of Twin City Rise joined our board, and he is still on the board, He is no longer the CEO of Twin Cities Rise, but he's still on our board, Art Bierman. And the idea was that there's some complements to what our enterprise and model does with Twin Cities Rise, but there's a big difference. One is the educational gap and requirements that our participants need to enter Twin Cities Rise, high school diploma, ninth grade reading, and comprehension. Many of our men do not have, about half of our men do not have a high school diploma or GED, and about half of our men are reading and comprehending at an eighth grade level. And then we also provide all of the components that I mentioned earlier of the housing, the employment, the health and wellness, and the case management, which is a significant barrier for some of the participants going to Twin Cities Rise. They're really not able to deal with the homeless population because, as we said, without having a place to stay, you don't know what your next day is going to look like. So we certainly have some components that complement Twin Cities Rise, but we're certainly dealing with a higher risk population.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe Ms. White has my amendment ready.
Okay. Ms. White?
Yes. Madam Chair and members, regarding the reporting requirements, the subdivision indicates that an organization receiving a grant must report annually to the commissioner on the number of programs it includes. And Senator Nelson would like to.
What line, Ms. White?
Two. Four. State Minnesota. Number three, were women and minorities. Two, line 10. Two, and insert at least. Two, line 11. Insert at least one grant must be awarded to an organization in the non-metro area.
Thank you, Ms. White. Are members clear on the amendment?
Just one Senator clarification. thank you, Ms. White. You captured the essence of my amendment. I would just say that our reporting requirement should match and just say located in the non-metro area instead of outstate. And we can use the statutory definition of metro area in both places. Thank you.
Senator Hayden, to the amendment.
Well, yeah, to the amendment. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. So I'm starting to get a little concerned. And my concern is that as we kind of figure out what the grant-making process is, and it's typically competitive based on the criteria that we have here on the work that we want to have done, I feel like this is starting to become a little over-prescriptive. I am sensitive to the outstate issue, and as a matter of fact, Better Futures brought an outstate partner that is partnering with them on some of the work that they do. But I am concerned that if we are kind of saying that it must kind of go here, and I don't know who those folks are. I don't know if you have someone in mind. I don't know if you have someone in mind, or if there's someone in your neck of the woods that you would like to see it. But I'm just hoping that we're not kind of on the fly, if you will, kind of changing the essence of Senator Champion's bill before we've really had to have that kind of discussion. So if there is something, it feels like you might have something that you're thinking about, and I'm just trying to tease that out a little bit before I'm so comfortable with kind of changing these requirements in Senator Champion's bill. It does have another stop if it does get through here. It has to go to finance, and I think for me, I'd like to see us, before we kind of do this, I'd like for us to have this discussion, and maybe they can have it with you, or we can have it to figure out what we want to do and what the coalitions look like. So I don't know if I'd be able to support this today, not because I don't think it's the right thing to do. I'm just not quite sure that this is how we should do it.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Hayden, I think you bring up a very good point. And I think that was the thing that first made me start thinking about this bill. None of us like to write, none of us feel we should write legislation for a particular entity. And that's kind of how I felt this legislation was originally written, especially when it says up to three organizations. I find that language interesting, really, because typically when we have competitive funding, we as the legislature determine the amount of funding, and what the competition is based upon, but I don't recall us ever saying that there must be a certain, no more than a certain number of grantees. Now, maybe that's happened before, but I just, that was just new language to me. And for clarification, no, I don't have anyone in mind. I just know that communities all across the state want to help the chronically unemployed get employed. And so that is the intent of this, is that it serves not just one aspect of the state, but we know that there's service to all. But so I think we might even just strike out the language about up to three. I mean, that's kind of maybe one of the concerns, is that it does seem very prescriptive, saying up to three, and what's magic about that number, and why don't we let the dollars, the grant proposals compete according to the Senator Champion's proposal here, and not limit the number in statute.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. I think you're right. I do want to point us to the opening section, that it's this broader, hard to serve long-term unemployment, but the network for, or the Better Futures Minnesota, I have to get my name right, but in particular, if you look at line 1.9 towards the end, there's an emphasis, it says, such as veterans and individuals who have recently been released from incarceration, and individuals that have mental illness and chemical addiction. So what I know about this organization, and I know we try to write the language as broadly as possible, but let me get to the point, that who they're serving are people who have been this particular group. That doesn't mean that others can't come in. Is the highest and hardest to serve because of incarceration, which means that they have felonies, because that a good number of the population that they have has a diagnosed or undiagnosed mental illness, because a good number of the population is suffering from chemical dependency issues that haven't been resolved. So when they come back out of the institution, they kind of go back to their old ways that a lot of times got them in the situation that they were in. So though I applaud the author and the coalition in trying to be as inclusive as possible and talking to Senator Marty, one of the things that I think we want to be able to say is, who are these folks? So that's who they are, and a good percentage of them are African American. And in this particular instance with the Better Futures Minnesota, is that they're really hard to serve African American men who spent a lot of time in the criminal justice world, and these guys are doing a great job at not only getting them on their way, but they're spending a tremendous amount of time dealing with their mental health issues. And I know I'm going a little long to the amendment, but I just think I just wanted to put some context as to why we are trying to target this particular population and where they're located and where they ultimately come from. So
thank you, Senator Hayden. We need to close discussion on the amendment, or somehow get to a closure on the amendment. Senator Rosen, did you have...
To this amendment, thank you, Madam Chair. And for those who serve on the finance this morning, I was kind of on a tirade about Greater Minnesota and the disparity, the equity of it, and how funding should be equal for the homeless and for our safe harbor. But when it comes to this program, which I think, Ms. Heldon, wasn't I the chief author one time? And I do support this. As Senator Hayden said, it is for a specific population that is going to be in the metro. And I don't think the support system has been branched out or developed out in Greater Minnesota, or perhaps has the demand as it does up in the metro for this particular population. Twin Cities Rise, I would like to see that more out in Greater Minnesota and in the areas around the state. But for this particular grant program, I think it better serves this population here in the cities.
Senator Benson, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, I would offer to you that if you wanted to work on a written language amendment, I would be happy to offer it in finance after we've had a chance. You could talk with the author and figure out what the lay of the land is. I was first introduced to this organization, and the explanation of the population that they're treating, and you know I don't like carving out grants for specific entities, when they talked about what it was like for somebody to come out of prison, I believe their population's average 12 years, to come out of prison and be dropped into the middle of having to make every decision for themselves when they had lived in a world where every decision was made for them, there is a serious infrastructure that needs to be in place to provide sort of that bridge. And there might be other organizations around the state. I'm not saying there isn't another organization. I'm just saying in this context, I would be happy to work with you on language. We do need it in other places, but if they can get their legs under them for a really targeted population, I think we might be very pleased with the result.
And Madam Chair, if I might just say, we are definitely open to having that intentional, robust discussion, you know, outside of this forum right now, so that you have time, so that all the parties can come around the table and talk about it and talk about what makes sense in a real way, even including Talia Palmer, who's in Northwest, you know. And so with that being said, I would hope that you would consider that and allow us to have that sort of discussion as opposed to just doing it right now.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Champion, I definitely will do that and take you up on that offer. But let me be perfectly clear. There are these very same issues in areas other than the Metro County, and there are significant support structures in counties other than the seven-county metro area. And I think it's essential that as we talk, we can flesh this out. And that could certainly be part of the competitive grants, that it would need to go to a proven structure or system that's already in place, because it is difficult. You would not want this to start up in an area or with an organization that had no experience in this area, but it is very clear that there are areas that have this very same concern, and I think it's essential that they have equal access to these grants, and I would look forward to working with you to kind of address this. And just as a heads up, I think the other thing that I would be looking to address is the education aspect, which would be, you know, if participants don't have a GED, that should be part of participating, either looking, if they don't have a high school degree, either participating in getting a GED, or if they are illiterate, 75% of our prison inmates are illiterate. It's essential, whether it be through reading intervention or literacy intervention, that we actually build that literacy. So I think that's something I'm hoping you'll consider as friendly amendments as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, we are definitely open to that. We know that the committee has to continue to do its work. We're open to that because we recognize that this is a problem throughout our state, right? And so we want to be as helpful and as mindful of those folks in rural Minnesota and in your district and other places as well. So with that being said,
I'll withdraw my amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, for being willing to continue to work on the bill. Senator Hayden, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I'd like to move the bill. Well, it looks like Senator Nino wanted to.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Briefly, please.
Senator Champion, as I read the bill, it looks like the intent is for these organizations that are the grant recipients to go out, work with other corporations and companies and say, hey, look, we've got people here that we've been working with, and we want to get them placed. Can you help us with that and get them placed into those outside corporations? Is that the intent?
Senator Champion.
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, that is a part of it, right? So if some organization wants to come in and say and really articulate the work that they're doing, we want to welcome that work because that is a part of the process. That's a part of making sure that this hard-to-employ population gets the training, gets the support, and get the stability that they need in order to go forward. And a part of that is finding gainful employment so that they can be connected and that they have the intellectual capacity by which to go forward.
Okay, and then just a second
Senator
half of that
Nina,
question.
Briefly.
The way I read the structure of this bill, I don't see anything that would prohibit those organizations from bringing those people in-house using the grant funds. If the intent is not to allow that, and I'm not sure that it would be a good idea to allow that because you're potentially incentivizing organizations to bring on cheap help for the duration of the grant and getting them employed. And I'm not going to try and work on that and fix it here, but if that's not the intent at all, you might want to work with counsel to make sure that that's not allowed.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. We need to wrap up this bill. We have several other bills on the agenda, but I do have also Senator Hayden, Senator Laurie, Senator Eaton, and Senator Nelson wish to make comments. So, Senator Hayden.
Well, I know for the this is what I worried about with this bill, is that what we should be focusing on, because this is the health community, is the support from the Health and Human Service part of the initiative. The initiative clearly is multifaceted. So we've talked about education and job creation or working with folks. What they are asking for from us, from this particular committee, is all of the support that they get from the Health and Human Service perspective, making sure that their health is well, doing the support groups that in the supportive employment and supportive housing that we do fund out of this committee. Those are the things that are needed to kind of give the basis of all of the other things that we've been talking about, getting their GED, getting work certified, figuring out what the avenues should be for jobs and job creation. But I do want to remind the members and bring us back to what this committee does and what the good part of what the network does as part of bringing these, in their case, these African-American, predominantly African-American men in, is to give them a basis in which to go out and do these other things. So if there are other issues, I think that it would be helpful, and I would look at the bill authors, is to maybe start to look at other funding. So I think this funding is good to support the men and their health and human service needs moving forward. But if there are other educational needs that we want to see, then I think we should look at those budgets and help provide more services to those organizations that does that. But I think for context, we are really focused on the human service, health and human service needs of the participants in their program.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Champion, and to the testifiers. I had a similar line of comment, actually, and truthfully, when I look at it, the objectives of what the grant is it's incentive for private sector employment, it's job supports, and it's really not the core work of Health and Human Services. There is the healthcare link. There's the foster cross-agency collaboration to try to reduce government costs. We'll take a look at the fiscal note and see if we see some of that cost savings. But, I mean, absent that, it really appears to me like a jobs program there's a, certainly a corrections link. There's a deed link. There are Health and Human Services aspects, and I recognize that, but you know, having not seen the targets yet, I'm looking down the road. History is my guide. It's going to be very, very difficult to balance the entire needs of what we do in HHS, and job support program might be difficult. So we'll be needing to ask those questions as we move forward. I do understand that similar grant programs like this have been run from corrections vantage point, maybe from DEED as well. I'm not certain, but we'll have to ask some of those questions as we move along. And I do know that we need to move along today, so I'll leave it as a comment.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank Senator Champion for bringing this bill forward. I think it's great policy. And I do believe the matching requirement of the dollars is sufficient to keep people in the game who actually have resources. So I'm not concerned about the other piece.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. And I do support Better Futures and Twin Cities Rise. I've carried their legislation before, and I appreciate what you're doing here. And I will say ABE does offer GED free, so there's not additional funding necessarily there, but it is a different area, I understand, than what we're dealing with today. But, Madam Chair, I would offer the first part of my amendment, which is the reporting piece, which I think Senator Champion said was a friendly amendment, which actually might help us get to just keeping track of where those dollars go, and maybe there isn't a need to say it needs to go to a certain place or another, which I agree, we don't always need to be so structured, but having a reporting mechanism in place that actually tracks that, I think, would help us going forward in the future. So do you accept that as a friendly amendment, the reporting language?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we do see the concept as a friendly notion, but I always feel much better when parties have had an opportunity to sit down and talk about it and see how it, you know, complements other parts of the bill and so on and so forth. So we just want to make sure that you have an opportunity along with all the necessary parties to talk about it and just make sure we have a robust and comprehensive discussion about it. So if you don't mind, we can maybe, engage each other in this discussion post this committee hearing.
Senator Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, I misunderstood it. It wasn't exactly a friendly amendment, but it's friendly thoughts. And so I'll look forward to following up with you on that improved language. And in the meantime, then I'll withdraw that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, would you like to move the bill?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves to recommend Senate file number 452 as amended to pass and be referred to finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes. Thank you, Senator Champion and testifiers. Next on our agenda is Senate File 513, Mobile Food Shelf Grant Program Establishment and Appropriation, Senator Herr. And a comment, we have four bills remaining on the agenda. We're going to have to be very, very brief as possible with your testimony so that we are able to get through all four of the bills.
Sure.
So if you have a way to pare down your testimony and have fewer testifiers, that would be appreciated as we do need to get through. And we have maybe a 10-minute cushion on the end of the agenda. We can go about 10 minutes, but that's all. So, Senator,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and briefness is my trait, too. So I
will
go as fast as I can. Well, thank you for hearing Senate 5513. This bill is about mobile food shelf. There are a growing number of people in Minnesota who have barriers accessing to food shelves due to mobility issues, disabilities, lack of transportation, and being far from local food shelves. And by delivering food directly to apartments, buildings, churches, community colleges, and low-income neighborhoods, the mobile food shelf programs increases access to nutritious food to people with barriers. In my district, I have heard from Mary Community Center, local churches, and people about the need to expand the mobile food shelves programs. They need funding in order to serve more people. Working with Hunger Solution Minnesota, we developed this bill, Senate File 513, to address the issue. And there are many benefits to increase mobile food shelves programs. One is its cost effectiveness comparing to building more food shelves. And two is it reduces stigma for seniors needing food support. And three, it's very effective in the rural areas where food shelves are not nearby. Madam Chairs and members, we have an opportunity to bring much needed food assistance to many of our fellow Minnesotans that are currently have don't have access to traditional food shelves. So I ask for your support of this bill. And with me to testify is Peter Wattock and of Hunger Solution, and Byron Laher of SEEP, who will give some comments and also join me in answering any question that you may have.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Wattock, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peter Wattock, community organizer with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Mobile Food Shelf Grant Bill, Senate File 513. Hunger in Minnesota is still a growing concern. Even with our improved economy, we've still seen many Minnesotans working at jobs that keep them at poverty levels. And we have one in five families now in Minnesota that are food insecure. And so many of these families rely upon our food shelf partners across the state to keep their families nourished. And Senator Herr mentioned some of the reasons why mobile food shelf programs exist now to really reach people who have mobility barriers, transportation barriers, seniors with a stigma barrier. So many factors nowadays where people just aren't able to make it to a food shelf. locally. And so we at Hunger Solutions Minnesota have been working with the Mobile Food Shelf Network providers that do distribute this food throughout the past year. And so we've seen those needs grow at apartment buildings, low-income neighborhoods, churches, and schools across the state. And so there are currently 9 mobile food shelf providers distributing over 1 million pounds of food to over 50,000 individuals. But those needs, as I mentioned, are growing, and we've heard that from several food shelves across the state. And we see that number growing quite a bit, probably around 25% over the next year. But in order to continue to reach and expand that reach to other people in need, funding is needed for a lot of these smaller to mid-sized food shelves to develop their own programs. And that's exactly what this bill would do, is give them the resources to either develop a program or for an existing mobile food provider to expand their services to reach others in need. And so the funds would go through Hunger Solutions Minnesota to distribute as grants to these food shelves, and that is something we have a 15-year track record of doing, is partnering with the Department of Human Services to do that with our grant program with the food shelves. And so mobile food shelf programs are a hunger relief tool that can be expanded in Minnesota and really can be a model for the rest of the nation, and would be a great step toward alleviating hunger for many seniors and others experiencing barriers toward getting to a traditional food shelf here in the metro and greater Minnesota. And we encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lauer, briefly to the sure. to support the bill.
Right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm Vice President at CEAP, Community Emergency Assistance Programs. We operate 2 food shelves, one in Anoka County, one in Hennepin County. We also provide Meals on Wheels to 300 seniors and adults with disabilities on a regular basis. We are also active with the Minnesota Hunger Initiative and the Partnership to End Hunger. And the reason I mention these is because we have all learned that throughout Minnesota, many families who have a food need have difficulty accessing the food shelves. And without repeating what you heard from the senator and from Peter, we know seniors and individuals with disabilities lack mobility. Many families simply lack transportation. And to be really candid, public transit was never designed to be for grocery shopping. Virtually all of the 300 food shelves in Minnesota are looking for ways to deliver needed food in cost-effective manner to families who can't get to a traditional food shelf. One of these ways is to retrofit vehicles and bring food to where the people are. The agency that I work with is a lot like the other 299 food shelves. We have good procurement networks, and we can source food for free or at greatly reduced prices. What we don't have is the funding to provide the capitalization needed to retrofit these vehicles. And that's really what this bill would provide to the food shelves across the state. I thank you for your time and encourage your support.
Members, any questions regarding Senate File 513? All right, seeing no questions, would someone?
I'll move it.
Senator Hoffman moves. Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 513 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much for your testimony
today.
Thank
you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to be brief.
Thank you. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have Senate File 238, Senator Eaton. This is the Medical Assistance Employed Persons with Disabilities Program Premium Payments Reduction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have the A1 amendment, and it'll put it in the order I wish the bill to be in. It essentially deletes a lot of page 3 of the bill that would have cost money.
Okay. Senator Eaton offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Senator Eaton, to your bill.
Thank you. This bill removes the large increase in premiums for persons with disabilities who are trying to become more independent by using the medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities options. Two numbers comprising the premium were changed back in 2011, and the premium increase was adopted in 2011 during the year's budget deficit crisis and was delayed until 2014. So they first were charged with these increases in October. Since that time, DHS data indicates that about 520 more people have disenrolled than was typical for the same period last year. So this allows people with a disability who have earned income to pay a premium for medical assistance rather than the spend down of all their income to 75% of the federal poverty level. So, and Senator Hoffman has a bill that will raise the poverty level next. But
and your testifiers, welcome to the committee, Anne Henry. I have, if you could keep your testimony brief, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name, for the record, is Anne Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. And we'd like to thank Senator Eaton for offering this bill. This is a key priority for the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, CCD, and that's likely why many of you have heard from constituents affected by this. I think a lot of you are familiar with the fact that this is a really important work incentive. It allows people to benefit from their earnings because they can pay a premium instead of having all the money they earn spun down. About 8,700 people now benefit from this program, but as Senator Eaton mentioned, more people are not able to participate now and are getting disenrolled because of the premium, so we're very concerned about it. One other point to understand is that when this was added to the budget deficit solution in 2011, the savings to the state are only half the amount of what people have to pay. In other words, people are paying twice because half goes to the federal government, which hasn't even asked for it, but that's how Medicaid program works. So it's a substantial burden for these folks and really contrary to our policy. So thank you very much. We ask for your support.
Thank you.
My name is Erica Schmiel, and I am here to assist Jim. Jim is going to introduce himself. I will translate, and then I will read the testimony Jim has written.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Carlisle.
My name is Jim Carlisle.
I live in West St. Paul.
I live in West St. Paul. I am a 78-year-old accountant. Tax accountant. I currently serve the taxpaying public using the work incentive program called Medical Assistance for Employed People with Disabilities, or MAEPD. While working with this program, I'm allowed to pay a monthly premium to receive medical assistance, including attendant care. These services are essential to my independence. This program has allowed me to accumulate a comparatively small retirement fund, build a wheelchair-sized home, and purchase an accessible vehicle. The real estate taxes, insurance, and maintenance on these assets take much of my modest income. Then last year, my MAEPD premiums jumped from $43 to $118 a month. That was a 277% cost increase, while my income stayed steady. If these unexpected and excessive premium increases would be imposed on the general public, most people would be searching for lower insurance rates. People with disabilities usually do not have that option. MAEPD premiums must be rolled back to the pre-increase levels. Policymakers say they want to keep people with disabilities in their homes and engaged in the community because it is better for their overall health. This can only be accomplished by taking the legislative measures necessary to decrease expensive insurance premiums to disabled people. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing your testimony to the committee today. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? Senator Eaton.
I just want to reiterate that people on MAEPD are working and trying to increase their independence. These are people who want to work. They don't want to sit home and collect benefits. They want to contribute to their community. So I urge your passage of this bill, and I would like to move it as amended.
Senator Eaton moves. Senate file 238 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Gotcha.
Next, we have Senate File 566, Senator Hoffman. This is medical assistance spend down procedures modification. And Senator Hoffman, I see. Do you have an amendment for this?
Madam Chair and members, yeah, there's an A1 author's amendment. I want to move that now, put the bill in the shape that I want. If there are any questions, clarifying questions, Mr. Moynihan can walk us through the amendment if the chair would like.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 566 is a bill that moves the spend down collection responsibility from service providers to the state. And with me at the table today is David Hancock, who's the Chief Operating Officer of ACRA Care. Don't ask me the ACRA name. I blew it up the other day, too, so you'll tell us what ACRA Care is. And with me is Ani Simons, who's here if you want to get deep in the weeds, and we can spend 3.5 hours talking about the technical aspects of this bill. She'd be more than happy to handle that. But if not, we're just going to go on forward with Senate File 566 really is about who is responsible for collecting the spend down payment from individuals on medical assistance. The bill's purpose is to shift this responsibility for spend down collections from the provider of the service to the state of Minnesota. And why is that such a deal? And I'll tell you a little bit more is, you know, you're talking about some folks in medical assistance, they're probably garnishment proof. You can judgment, but you cannot garnish. And so if you're the collector under the Fair Debt Collections and Practices Act, you're not going to be able to collect any money from folks anyway because of the fact that they're protected by federal law. And so that really puts the folks that are being the vendors into a really adverse situation. So right now the current MA income eligibility standard is 100% of poverty, and with the spend down level at 75% of poverty. So if a person makes 100% of poverty is eligible, but a person making that amount plus $1 more, so it's always $1 more than 100% of poverty, in order to be eligible for the MA has to spend down to 75%, and that is including the medical expenses as well. So when a service provider performs a service to someone with a spend down, and then we bill the state for the service, the state will pay the providers only for claims after the spend down amount is met. Is that making sense? The provider is then instructed to collect the remaining portion of the payment from the individual they serve as part of the individual spend down. Because the income and asset levels of these individuals are subject to in order to access medical assistance is so low, they often don't have the money to pay their own spend down portion to the provider. What this does is it leaves the provider without full payment for the services that are already delivered. The provider then has to either spend resources to collect the payment, again, these folks are going to be judgment-proof, or observe those unpaid costs. Both options mean less resources for providing services, and the providers cannot afford to continue to do this, and that will keep their costs reasonable. So what we want to do in Senate File 566 is create a new process where the state reimburses the provider for the full MA rate of the services provided. The state then becomes responsible for collecting the spend down payment from the individual. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Hancock, who can further explain why this legislation is needed and the impact on the issue of his organization.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hancock. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Hancock, and I'm the CEO of ACRA. ACRA is a nonprofit organization that provides a wide range of person-centered, self-directed, and community-based home care services for people with disabilities and older adults. Currently, ACRA serves about 4,000 individuals across the state of Minnesota in 67 counties, and we employ more than 4,200 individuals. I want to thank Senator Hoffman for bringing forward this very important piece of legislation. As Senator Hoffman described in his opening comments, the current MA spend-down process is one that is broken for both participants and providers of services. While having a spend-down option here in Minnesota that allows individuals access to needed MA services is a very important part of our state's healthcare system, the way in which the spend-down collection is handled and the very low income limits that individuals are subjected to is somewhat problematic. At ACRA, along with many other service providers, we support shifting the responsibility for collecting the spend-down payments away from providers and to the state because, as providers, we want to focus on being a service provider and not be in the collection business. When we provide a service to someone, we want our relationship with that person to be focused solely on how we can best provide the service that they need. It is difficult to maintain this focus when we are put in the position of having to try to collect payments, spend down payments for those that we serve. And the details of those payments, the amount, how they impact eligibility, how they change from month to month, and other technical details are determined by the state and not by service providers. Currently, ACRA and other providers are put in the position of having to explain and defend to participants MA eligibility requirements and policies that are completely out of our control and are made at the state level. Additionally, as Senator Hoffman has mentioned, due to low income standards for this group that they're subject to, some of these individuals simply can't or won't pay their spend down. In addition to the high administrative costs that we absorb at ACRA in our work to try to collect spend down payments, it can be incredibly time consuming and time intensive based on the population that we work with. We also end each year with a high amount of uncollected spend down payments. For example, currently at ACRA, the amount of participant debt that's due to spend downs is over $70,000. And of that amount, approximately $50,000 is in our over 90 days of aged account receivables. We serve 12 individuals that owe over $2,000 and one individual whose debt is over $5,000. With the limited amount of earnings and assets that individuals are allowed to accumulate, most individuals will simply likely not be able to pay this amount to ACRA and will have to write it off. And even if the recipient of services is able to participate in a monthly payment plan, they are rarely able to make sizable enough payments to get ahead of the debt, so it becomes perpetual. At some point, many provider organizations are faced with the very real possibility of simply writing off large amounts of attributable spend downs as bad debt. So while shifting the spend down collection responsibility to the state will certainly help providers and participants by allowing them to focus solely on the services and not on the technical issues of eligibility requirements, and will help providers to be paid in full for the services they provide, I do, if Chair permits, I'd like to speak just very briefly to the broader spend down issue that will be addressed in the next bill that's on your agenda, Senate File 543.
If it's brief and
very brief,
and,
okay. 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We at ACRA and other providers strongly support increasing the income and asset limits themselves. As you'll hear in the next bill when it's presented, Minnesotans with disabilities and older adults are subject to a lower income and asset limits than any other category of individuals accessing MA coverage. If adults or seniors with disabilities make $1 more than $973 a month, they must spend down their income on medical expenses to $729 a month and keep their assets below $3,000 just to qualify and keep their MA services and supports. So being forced to live off of $729 a month, it's no surprise that some of these individuals simply won't be able to pay their spend-down amounts. There is no question that we all want people with disabilities and older Minnesotans to live more independently in communities of their choice and to have greater options for jobs and other community participation. Raising the income level and asset level for these groups so that they can have access to a little more of their incomes and assets each month would help achieve this goal. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Madam Chair, and I would ask your support for Senate File 566.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have, Ms. Hymans, did you have testimony? Okay. Members, do you have any questions about the bill?
Madam Chair?
Senator Hoffman.
I move Senate File 566 be referred to finance, where we can have, we're going to have a lot of MA spend down discussions, or finance will. So that would be what I like.
Right. Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 566 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Folks come up, Senate file, in the last one, 566, there's a letter from AARP, which, you know, I turned 50 2 weeks ago, and I got my Senator Rosen, I got my card. So the letter's there. But Senate file, as folks come up, Senate file 543 is the MA income and asset limit increase. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 543. This is a proposal that increases the income medical assistance eligibility limit, the asset limits, and the excess income standard for people with disabilities and the elderly. With me at the table today, Madam Chair and members, is Ann Henry. She's from the Legal Aid. And then Lane Beckman, who's from Brooklyn Center, Senator Eakin's area. And she is going to be talking, she is eligible for MA and waiver services. But briefly, and I mean briefly, this bill brings equity, it's equity for persons with disabilities and seniors who need medical assistance by increasing the income and asset limits for eligibility consistent with other groups. Remember 2 years ago when we came up with the ACA, it's consistent, and it's about increasing and being consistent with the eligibility of the other groups. So currently, persons with disabilities and seniors are limited to no more income than 100%. You heard this in the last bill, that if you make $1 more, you have to spend down to 75%. And in this case, it roughly gets to $730 a month. Every other group on MA now has an income limit at or above 133% of the federal poverty level. This bill brings persons with disabilities and seniors to the 133% of the federal poverty level. It also increases the asset limits, which are now $3,000 for individuals, and that has not been increased for over 25 years. That brings it to $10,000 per person or $18,000 per couple. These limits are consistent with the economic programs that have been simplified changes made last session for other DHS programs. Note that all other groups on MA have no asset limits, but the complications of seniors and long-term care costs make moving to no asset limit very costly. I threw it out there just so we know what we're looking at. I mean, if we really truly want to be fair and we want to be consistent and non-discriminatory, we need to have this open discussion. But again, I'd like this bill, when we get it, I want to get it referred to finance to have that discussion. Two more points, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Henry. Minnesota's policy is to encourage people with disabilities and seniors to live in their homes in the community. That's all we keep hearing about. There's a couple of lawsuits that went out there and some Supreme Court decision from 1999. You guys have heard it enough. But the low income and asset limits are significant barriers to these individuals who want to live as independently as possible in the community. It's Olmstead, okay, whatever. So the bill will affect about 40,000 people with disabilities and seniors. Those are folks both on the waiver programs and elderly waivered services. So we want those people to remain as independent as possible in their communities. So thank you, Chair. I went through that really fast. I wish I would have been first on the table, but that's okay. And I turn the mic over to Ms. Henry and Ms. Beckman.
Thank you. Ms. Henry, please, again, introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Ann Henry, Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. And we would like to really thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this issue up. It's a long-term issue, and we really hope that we can make progress this session to move toward equity for people with disabilities and seniors who are really left at the bottom of the pile while being expected to maintain themselves in the community. Very briefly, it is extremely significant that asset limit has not increased really since 1983. And think about the purchasing power in 1983 of $3,000 and whether or not you could afford to fix a roof or get a new refrigerator or get it fixed if it were broken. Today, that just really is a hardship for people. So that asset limit really has to move up as the bill does. And the income limit, both the qualifying income to 133 and the spend down limit would also do a lot to allow people to be more independent in the community. And we know that a lot of other programs have had to be constructed around this horribly low impoverishment level that people must comply with. And folks would not need all of that if they could keep more of their income. What is the income most of these folks have? Social Security. Certainly for seniors, that's true, and for many people with disabilities as well. So we really urge support for this bill. Thank you, Senator Hoffman, and I need to say again that it is a top priority for the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. And your next testifier, please welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Lane Beckman. I live in Brooklyn Center, as Senator Hoffman had said. In 2009, I underwent surgery to remove a large brain tumor and suffered a massive stroke. I knew the surgery carried risks, but without it, I would have died. Before my stroke, I was an extroverted multitask whiz. When I was 14, I was a certified nursing assistant, and I have degrees in paramedicine and nursing. After my stroke, I went from an IQ of 160 to a third grade level. I had to relearn to walk, talk, read, and write all over again. After 5 years of multiple therapies at Courage Center, my recovery has exceeded all expectations, but I still struggle with organizational skills, have a short-term memory deficit, and when I overextend, I need to go to bed for a long time to recover. I became eligible for the medical assistance and the waiver services after I spent my entire 401k of $300,000 on medical bills. It was terrifying losing the financial security I had built up from 30 years of working. I used to love my large mocha latte from Caribou. Now, for that same amount of money, I can buy a loaf of bread, a gallon of milk, and a small jar of peanut butter for a week's worth of lunches. I'm thankful for the ME waiver services that help me live independently. Without my ILS worker and medication management nurse, I could not manage to live fully and completely. I survive with the help of friends, food shelves, thrift stores, and perseverance. Here's why the ME income and asset standards need to be increased. I get $1,195 a month from Social Security Disability, but I'm expected to pay $466 for my medical and support services every month before MA starts to pay. This is known as my spend down to qualify for MA and waiver services. I pay $500 a month for rent and do household and outdoor chores in exchange for utilities. After paying my rent and MA spend down, I have $229 left of my SSDI income to pay all my other bills. Most months I don't have enough money to meet my basic needs. I worked hard my entire life, and I should not be forced into deep poverty to get the help I need while I get back on my feet. I am trying to make a better life for myself and am working towards starting my own insurance business. But until I can earn a steady income, I need the state's help. I went from a six-figure income to $14,000 a year. Now I feel like I'm invisible. Please see me and others like me and raise the medical assistance income, assets, and spend down standards. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you, Ms. Beckman. for sharing your story. So thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think there might be one of these in your packets as well to read your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Beckman, for being here. Madam Chair, barring any questions, I'd like to see Senate File 543 be passed and referred to Finance.
Members, are there any questions on the bill? No. I see no questions. So Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 543 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much for providing your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Oh, and that is our last bill on the agenda. Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
There you go. Cool. Yeah. Wow. Good.
Really, I was good.